Morning, Boker Tov, everybody. We're here at Matan in Ra'anana. Now, I mentioned that we might do Hinduism and Judaism today. We're not, because I realized, wait a second, Hanukkah is coming. And I was at Roladin, and there were donuts and sufganiyot. And I said, well, if they could start eating donuts and sufganiyot, you know, at the beginning of Kislev, then we should probably have something about Hellenism and Judaism and the encounter between these two systems of thought right before Hanukkah. Yes.
Rabbi Mamash Talbi, I hate to break this to you, but they started selling sufganiyot the day after Shmini Atzeret.
Wow. Okay. Yes. Well, I guess I was late on that, so I have to get with the program. But so what we're going to do is we're going to study Judaism's encounter with Hellenism, and I want to give you a new. This may not be a, well, there will be some new elements here, but there's a new moment in history, which is not directly connected to the Hanukkah story. It actually precedes it. And what I want to do is go back to the first time that there was an encounter between Jews and the Greeks, the Hellenists. Now, just to understand things from a historical standpoint, in about the year, the first encounter that we know of between the Jews and the Greeks is found in a legend of sorts that's recorded in the book of Josephus. And in Josephus' writings, he writes about a Jew from Syria who travels to Greece and encounters Aristotle and had this conversation, and Aristotle was going to, you know, teach him some stuff. And then Aristotle realized that there was a lot more to learn from the Jew than he thought. And he says, wow, this guy must come from a race of philosophers. So that's the first, you know, sort of legendary encounter. But the encounter between us and the Greeks really begins with which figure, anybody know? Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great conquers, sets out to conquer, you know, the Mediterranean base, Middle East, all the way until India in 330 BC. Okay? And there's stories in the Talmud about this, legends in the Talmud about his encounter when he gets to Jerusalem with the Kohen Gadol there. But Bekitsur, Alexander, you know, he builds this huge empire. And then he dies, okay? And his generals split up his kingdom. So a general by the name of, well, who's in Egypt? Anybody know who's in the area of Egypt and then Israel? Anybody know? Ptolemy. Ptolemy, spelled with a P. Ptolemy is the general that gets control of Egypt and the land of Israel. Another general by the name of Seleucus gets control of the area of Asia Minor and Syria and Damascus, that region. Now, the reason this is relevant is because our interaction with the Greeks is both through the Ptolemaeans as well as the Seleucids, if you will. Okay, these two different kingdoms. Because, I'm just going to write this down, Alexander conquers the Middle East, you know, he's around 330. Okay, and that's Alexander. Okay, but then he dies in 323. So in 323, Alex dies. Okay, his kingdom is split up. From the period of 323 to 200 BC, this is before the BCE, before the Common Era.
You need the board.
No, it's fine. No, this is good. This is keeps everybody focused. It's good. No problem.
Next week.
Yes.
Okay, because you're signing up for the class. But bring friends.
Okay, bring your friends. Okay, and your daughters or granddaughters or whatever. It is. So from 323 to 200 BCE, area of Israel is under control of the Ptolemies. Okay, from 200 to then about 63 BCE. So this is the period of the Ptolemies.
263.
And this is the period of the Seleucids. Now, in which period does Hanukkah take place?
The Seleucids.
Exactly. Hanukkah is over here. In about 160 BC, you have Hanukkah.
I can't see. You moved them.
Okay, 160. I just wrote 160 Hanukkah. Yeah, it's over. Okay, 160. In 160 BCE is when Hanukkah takes place, but that's under the Seleucid kingdom, okay? It's the, whereas the Ptolemies, we have a different interaction we're going to talk about today. Okay? So this is the story that precedes the story of Hanukkah, okay? And that's why this is interesting. It's a little bit different and out of the box. Now, we're going to start with, so we're talking about a period of around about 200 BC. That's when we're talking about now, 230, 220, 200 BC. And we're going to start with a letter. We're going to start with a letter, but the letter's called the Letter of Aristeus. Okay, this is a letter which is written by, it appears to be a Greek, a Jew, living in Egypt at the time. Now remember, what does Alexander, what becomes the center of the universe after Alexander dies? What city? Alexandria, okay? In northern Egypt, Alexandria becomes the center of this Hellenistic civilization. There was a huge, the largest library in the world at the time was housed there. And there was an attempt to get all the books of the world and translate it into Greek and to bring them in, you know, to, into this huge library, this storehouse. And so you could imagine one of the books that they wanted to get a copy of was the Torah, okay? I mean, you have to have it on the shelf, right? So so there's this letter from Aristeas, which describes the story of how they managed to get a copy of the Torah in Greek. This is a story which is sort of well known. Anybody know what the name of this translation is? The Septuagint, whatever it is. And we're going to see different versions of the story. And not only different versions, but we're going to see there are a lot of politics and cultural questions that arise as a result of this incident. And it has a lot to teach us about our relation with Hellenism and the outside world. So let's see this letter. Letter of Aristeas, Demetrius of Phalerum, the president of the king's library. He was a librarian, received vast sums of money for the purpose of collecting together as far as he possibly could all the books in the world. By means of purchase and transcription, he carried out to the best of his ability the purpose of the king. I am told that the laws of the Jews are worth transcribing and deserve a place in your library. They need to be translated, answered Demetrius, for in the country of the Jews, they use a peculiar alphabet, just as the Egyptians too have a special form of letters and speak a peculiar dialect. And the king, when he understood all the facts of the case, ordered a letter to be written to the Jewish high priest that his purpose, which has already been described, might be accomplished. The king ordered a letter to be written to Eleazar, the high priest, on the matter. The high priest selected men of the finest character and the highest culture, such as one would expect from their noble parentage. They were men who had not only acquired proficiency in Jewish literature, but had studied most carefully that of the Greeks as well. They were specially qualified, therefore, for serving on embassies, and they undertook this duty whenever it was necessary. So they set to work comparing their several results and making them agree. Now, basically, who is this? Anyone know who the king is at this point? It's King Ptolemy Philadelphus. Okay, you know Philadelphia cream cheese? Okay, that's where it comes from. Okay, so which you can get here at the supermarket. So they set to work comparing. So they bring together these scholars. He writes a letter to the high priest in Jerusalem. We need some help to do this. The high priest acquiesces, and so they get a group together. And so it chanced that the work of translation was completed in 72 days. How long did it take? 72 days. Underline that. Just as if this had been arranged of set purpose. When the work was completed, Demetrius collected together the Jewish population in the place where the translation had been made and read it all over to all, in the presence of the translators, who met with a great reception also from the people, because of the great benefits which they had conferred upon them. They bestowed warm praise upon Demetrius too, and urged him to have the whole law transcribed and present a copy to their leaders. So a copy was being made for the library, but who else wants a copy of the book? The Jews are like, this is amazing. We want to copy this. After the books had been read, the priests and the elders of the translators and the Jewish community and the leaders of the people stood up and said that since so excellent and sacred and accurate a translation had been made, it was only right that it should remain as it was and no alteration should be made in it. And when the whole company expressed their approval, they bade them pronounce a curse in accordance with their custom upon anyone who should make any alteration, either by adding anything or changing in any way, whatever, any of the words which had been written or making any omission. So they do this translation, and the Jews are ecstatic about this. I mean, this is this unbelievable, you know, it's like a very positive thing. You can imagine a celebration, a formal reception, wine and cheese, and all these different, so they're very, the people in Alexandria are ecstatic with this, the work that had been created here. So this was the this is from the letter of Aristeas, and this is the first version we have of this story. How many Jewish scholars were involved?
70.
No,
70?
Does that say it? Does it
no,
say that?
It doesn't say.
What's 70? 72 is what? The number of days it took to do this. There's no mention of the number of scholars. Okay? We have to get there. Okay, so this is first in the letter of Aristeas. Let's look at a second version, which we're not going to... It comes from Philo. Philo was... Anybody know who Philo was? Philo was a Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria. Wikipedia said somewhere between 50 BC and 20 CE. This is the time of Hillel and Shammai. This is the time that of Jesus. This is when the Romans are already have control of the area of Judea, but it's still, you know, Greek culture is dominant, and Philo is a Jewish philosopher, and he tried to connect Greek wisdom and Jewish thought. And he writes about this as well. And he writes, this is from an article. I just want to point out, this is from an article by a scholar by the name of Moshe Shoshan, called The Task of Translation, of Translators, The Rabbis, the Septuagint, and the Cultural Politics of Translation. Moshe Shoshan is a great scholar. He's a friend of mine. And he sent me a copy of this article just recently. So I want to thank him for some of this research, as well as another friend, Shlomo Zuckier. Rabbi Shlomo Zuckier also put together some material on this. So Philo's, what does he say here? Philo's elders are most concerned with achieving a proper state of purity before engaging the divine texts. Philo goes even further, arguing that the translation was a direct result of an encounter between the translators and God himself. This is now from Philo's work. Having taken the sacred scriptures, they lifted up them in their hands also to heaven, entreating of God that they might not fail in their object. As he assented to their prayers, therefore, they, like men inspired, prophesied, not one saying one thing and another, but every one of them employed the self-same nouns and verbs, as if some unseen prompter had suggested all their language to them. These translators were not mere interpreters, but hierophants and prophets, to whom it had been granted in their most honest and guileless minds to go along with the most pure spirit of Moses. Tell me about these translators. Don't tell me what you were told. Enough of what you've been told. I'm asking you what it says in the text. What happened here?
They were divinely inspired.
And why were they? What is the value of them having been divine? Why do they need to be divinely inspired? What do you think? That's again what you know beforehand. That's not what he says. Yeah.
Can you imagine? Can we even think of such a thing as a room full of Jewish scholars not arguing?
Okay, so it's interesting. Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, who writes about this, is quoted as saying that he said, well, we haven't gotten there yet. So, you know, I'm going to hold off on Rav Kuttner for 1 second. Why do they need divine inspiration? Yeah. Who, what? Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea. It's a good question. Someone wants to look it up, you can look it up and tell me what it means. What's a hierophant? A hierophant? I don't know. You can look it up. What do they need? What does the divine inspiration help them do?
Because it'll be acceptable.
Okay, so it helps them to be able to interpret the Torah into Greek text, Greek writing, which is not necessarily an easy thing to do. And so God himself inspired them to help them in this process. But the other thing that this does, by suggesting that God was involved in this process, it sort of puts a halo over this whole process. Yeah. Meaning it wasn't only divinely inspired, but divinely sanctioned. God said, yes, yes, you should translate the Torah into Greek. We're looking at Philo right now. We're looking at Philo, okay? And this would seem to suggest that this was first of all, a positive incident. This positive what happened here. So let me just read here from another piece. One second. Here it is. Okay. Through the translation, this is not in your source sheet, through the translation of the Torah into Greek, its wisdom will now be able to transform all humankind morally and spiritually, not merely Jews. This is what Philo is thinking. There is nothing subversive about the translator's activities. Let's go on here 1 second. Like the author of Aristeas, Philo's view of the larger cultural ramifications of the translation is rooted in his deep commitment to both Hellenistic and Hebraic cultures and his conviction that the two are not at odds. So what Philo sees divine sanction here, because we have two great traditions, the Greek tradition, the Jewish tradition, which really are teaching the same truths, and now we could talk about them in the same language, and now they'll be accessible, and they'll be universally available to everybody. It's sort of like when you put everything up on, you know, online. Everyone can access them, okay? He sees this as a positive thing, and it will bring together the unity of wisdom, which can both be found in Judaism and Greek wisdom. And this again relates to Philo's own view that the Hebraic and Hellenistic traditions can be synthesized and are ultimately saying the same thing. Okay, so, but it's also the divine inspiration is needed to engage in a translation, which is a challenging thing. Okay, let's now look at the third version of the story. Okay, and this may be one that you're more acquainted with, which is in the Talmud Bavli Masachah Megillah Daf Tet Amud Bet. Okay, so the let's read it in the Hebrew. Maaseh D'Tanya on the bottom of page 1. Maaseh B'Talmai Hamelech with Talmai the King. Shekines Shivim Ushnaim Zikenim, who gathered together 72 scholars, not 72 days, but 72 scholars. Vehechnisan Bishivim Ushnaim Batim. And he put them into 72 different homes, or houses, rooms. Velo Gilalahem Amalkin San. He didn't even tell them why he was doing this. Sounds like they're being imprisoned almost. Yeah, it's almost like this, you know, recently when the Saudi Arabian king like kidnapped the Lebanese prime minister. He's like, oh, just come on a trip to Saudi Arabia. You know, he came. He's like, oh, by the way, your hotel room is now your cage. You know, this is sort of what happens here. Okay, v'nichnas etzol kol achad achad v'amar lahem, and he told them, kitvu li Torat Moshe Rabchem, write for me the Torah of your teacher Moses. Natan ha-kadosh baruch hu b'leiv kol achad v'achad etza. God placed in them great wisdom. V'iskimu kulan adat achat, and they all agreed to the same translation. And now what is significant about this is that they all changed certain aspects of the translation, but they did this in a uniform manner as if they were sitting in the same room. Now here comes Rav Yitzchak Kuttner's joke, which I heard from, which is as follows. The miracle is not that they came up with the same translation being in different rooms. It would have been more of a miracle if they'd been in the same room and came up with the same translation. Okay, Rabbi Norman Lamb is quoted as saying, how do we know, you know, there's this line, Amar Rabbi Chanin Tamadei Chachamim Marbim Shalom Ba'olam. Says, how do we know that the rabbis have a sense of humor? Rabbi Norman Lamb, Tamidei Chachamim Marbim Shalom Ba'olam. That the rabbis bring peace to the world, you know, anything but peace. So,
you know what Rabbi Cook's drash on that is?
Yes. Nachon, it's a beautiful, I've taught it before in shul. So this is, now, the key point is that they change certain things about the text. Let me give you some examples of what they change. Okay? So they say, for example, the very first words, V'katfulo breshit Elohim bara breshit Elohim bara breshit. Okay? So it's not breshit bara Elohim, which sounds like there's this being called breshit, and that created God, rather, Elohim bara breshit. In the beginning, God created in the beginning, or, you know, time itself. Another example, Ese Adam b'tzelem uvidmut. I will make man in his tzel, in my image. Well, how is that different than what it says in the Torah itself? Nah, we will make man. You might think that, I don't know, we're idolaters, we're polytheists here. Also, Vayichal bayom hashishi, vayishbot bayom hashvi'i. Now, in our text, what does it say? No, vayichal bayom hashvi'i melachto. It says that he finished the work on the seventh day. But if he finished on the seventh day, it means he was working on the seventh day. So they changed it to vayichal bayom hashishi. They finished on the sixth day. Okay. So these are some of the examples that we see. There's another example that Zachar Nekeva Bara Bira'o Velo Katvu Bira'am. Okay, it's singular as opposed to plural. Hava erda ve'evle sham sfatam. God says, I will go down. Not we will go down to confuse the Babylonians and Migdal Babel. I will go down. Okay? So these are a number of the different, and I think there are 13 in all. Okay? So this is a third version of the story. Now what's different about this version of the story is that in contrast to Aristeus's and Philo's, which celebrate this whole process, and just to tell you even more with Aristeus, there's this whole party with the king, with Ptolemy, and this whole interaction with him. The story is, for Aristeus, is a symbol of, again, of the ability of the Jews in Alexandria to merge with, to acculturate into the larger Greek society. Okay, and this was a very positive development in that stage in that development. Huh? Yeah, certainly, absolutely. Okay. But here we see here, well, for the first time, we're seeing here this tension. There's this conflict because the scholars are being forced to translate the text. They're doing it, if you will, against their will. And they're not able to communicate. Their phones are taken away. They can't text. They can't talk to each other. Okay? And there's another form of divine inspiration. What's the divine inspiration doing in this? In this story, what is it doing in this story?
Guiding
them to do what?
To make changes to avoid
problems, political problems with the larger dominant culture in which they are subservient to. Okay, now just give you one more example that I think is relevant. You know, they also took out the pasuk about Shimon and Levi killing the city of Shechem. Why might that be something you want to take out or reinterpret? Because, you know, the Jews want to show that they're good neighbors. You know, we're going to bring you apple pie. We're not going to kill you. You know, so this is a challenge. You know, that's another thing that they take out. So there are a number of interesting changes that they make. So this is the third version. Okay, so it's sort of like there could have been this terrible crisis, but guess what? God intervened, divine inspiration, everything worked out in the end. Okay, and guess who didn't know about the changes in the translation? Who didn't know? The Greeks had no idea. They had no idea because they didn't really understand. So there was the Jews succeeded at sort of keeping the Torah, the truer, the deeper, the secrets of the Torah to themselves. Okay, and we're going to talk about the challenges of interpretation. Okay, but let's look at version number four. Version number four can be found in Masechto Ketanot, Masechet Sefer Torah. Okay, it's version number four. And this we're going to call, Moshe Shimshon calls this the catastrophic version. Okay, this is the previous version, number three, was almost a catastrophe, but no, it was fine. God intervened. Now we're going to see the catastrophic version. Okay, so it says, Lo ko'en kotvin, lo ivrit, velo ilmit, velo midit, velo yevanit. One should not translate the Torah into any of these languages. Shivim zekenim kitvu, now it's 70 scholars, kitvu kol ha-Torah le-talmai ha-melech l'shon yevanit. 70 Jewish scholars translated or kitfu, which is interesting that they use the word kitfu here, not tirgimu. They wrote it in Greek, Lashon Yevanit. V'haya oto ayom, that day, the day that this happened, hayom kashel Yisrael kiyom she'asu bo at ha'egel. That day was as bad for the Jewish people as the day that what? The Egel HaZahav was created. That's pretty intense. Egel HaZahav is an idol. The Torah is the Torah, the most holy object that we have. How does the Torah turn into an idol? We're going to have to explore this. Now, this version, this understanding of the issues is so problematic, this catastrophic perspective, that we do something practically because of what happened then. And what is that? Nu, what do?
Question.
we fast on Asara B'Tevet. Look at the Shulchan Aruch. V'shmona B'Tevet. Okay, the eighth of the Tevet, Nichteva HaTorah Yevanit. B'mei Talmai HaMelech. On the eighth, this is one of the reasons that we fast on Asara B'Tevet. It was also there was a siege around Yerushalayim, been a breach, but V'hayach Hoshech V'olam Shlosha Yamim. And there was darkness in the world for 3 days. Okay, fine. So 3 days, 8, 9, 10. And that's why we fast on Asara. This is one of the reasons we fast on Asara B'Tevet. Okay, so what the Greeks did has a big influence on us. Okay, and you see other versions, another source from the Cairo Geniza that also suggests Me'oto Ayom She'asabo Ega. It's like the day the golden calf was created, the day that the Torah was translated into Greek. We have to understand what was so problematic here. What was so problematic with this translation? What do you think? No, we're not even talking about changing the word. What's the problem with the translation? Yeah.
I think the problem with the translation is it gives access to everyone, and not only Jews. And once it's in Greek, it's going to be translated into other languages, and there'll be lots of mistranslations and changes along the way.
Ah, okay. Yeah, so here we get to a discussion about translation and authority and possession. Okay? And we're going to talk about how, the people who have access to a text also control that text. Okay? And once something is translated, you lose control and supervision of what happens to that text. Okay? And we're going to get there. Now, what is it? How do we resolve? How might we resolve the tension between the four different sources here that we're seeing? Okay, we're seeing four totally different versions of this story. Okay, now, some of this, one way of understanding this, the different versions of the story can relate to, well, how positively or negatively do you look at Greek wisdom and Hellenism? If you see it as a positive force in the world, so you're going to be more supportive of the translation, a la Aristeas and Philo. If you are more suspect of Greek wisdom and Hellenism and this very universal outlook and the Greek Olympics and everyone running around naked, you are going to be more suspect and see this as catastrophic, right? So that might be one way of resolving the tension between these different sources. And indeed, we do see conflicting understandings of Greek in general and Greek wisdom. Okay, there's an idea, Masachat Sota, you shouldn't teach your children Greek wisdom. Let's look at the next source. Okay, Acher. Okay, Acher, remember, is... Acher was... who was Acher? Tell me who Acher was. Elisha ben Abuya, who goes off the path. What caused him to go off the path? You have to read the Driven Leaf. Right? What caused him to go to that? Okay. His exposure to Greek wisdom. Acher, my zamar yivani lo pasak mipume. Okay. He never stopped singing Greek songs. He was always singing Greek songs. Amru alav al acher. They said about acher. Bishashaya omid veit mi amidrash. Harbe sifrei minin noshun mechiko. When Acher would get up from his seat in the Beit Midrash studying his Gemara and his Shas and Poskim, all these books would fall off his lap, and he'd see all these Aristotle and Socrates and Plato. And so you see that this is ultimately what corrupted Acher's mind, and it's Greek wisdom. Okay, we see more tension surrounding this. Tosefta and Masechet Avodah Zarah Perek Aleph Halacha Kaf Shalot Rabbi Yoshua. They asked Rabbi Yoshua, "Ma'u shel yomar adam et beno yivani? Can you teach your son Greek?" Amar lehen yomad, you should teach them. B'sha'a she'en lo min hayom v'lo min halayla, at a time when it's not day or night. Okay, as it says, v'igita bo yomad v'layla. What do you make of this? What is he saying here?
In the 45 minutes between Shkia and
Shkia. Okay, maybe, okay, between day and night. Yeah, okay, what do you think he's really saying here? Well, it's sort of yes and no. He's saying, not at all. Don't actually teach your kid Greek. In theory, is there value to Greek? Yes, there is. We just have all these other priorities, like studying Torah all the time. So it's just lower down on the list of priorities. But it's not bad in principle, okay? And, and I'll just give you one more example, which is a more positive perspective. Talmud Bavli Masachet Megillah. This is the rest of the Gemara after Talmud. And Shimon Gamliel taught. Even for Torah scrolls, they only allowed them to be written in Greek. So you can't write the Torah in any other language but Hebrew and Greek. Rabbi Abba and Rabbi said, Rabbi Yochanan said, the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. That's the halacha. And Rabbi Yochanan said, what is the reason Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, God should enlarge Yefet and he shall dwell in the tent of shame. Yaft Elohim liyefet v'yishkon be'ohalei Shechem. These are the Yefet is one of the children of Noach. Okay. And Shem is another child of his. And Yefet comes from Yefet, beauty, splendor. The Greeks are often associated with light, illumination, beauty, splendor. Look at their architecture. Look what they built. And so they will shall dwell in the tent of Shem. And the tent of Shem is associated with the Jewish people. Okay. Semites. Okay. And so this is, so we see here that there is even the Torah permits some element of Greek wisdom coming into our home, or Greek culture coming into our midst. So we see here really a collection of sources, a range of views, and this might point to the positive or negative versions with regards to the translation of the Septuagint. Additionally, there may be another issue, another element here. Yeah. I don't think it's take over.
Even if you think of Yefet as being...
No, but look, the words of Yefet will be in the tents of shame. They'll be there. They'll be on the shelf along with the other books. It's not going to take over, but maybe that's the challenge. Will it...
Do you think of Yefet also the Christians?
I think it's more associated with the Greeks. Edom is more known as the Christians. It's possible. It's possible. Okay, but we'll get there. Now, there may be another element here, and the other element is, and this may be true of Greek wisdom or knowledge or culture, as well as any other culture. Okay, because the Torah has been translated into many other languages. Who translated the Torah into Arabic? Anybody know? I think Rav Sadia Gaon. Who translated the Torah into German? No. I was Jew. Actually, Moses Mendelssohn. Okay, the Biur. Okay, so the Torah has been translated into different languages. Okay, but there's a challenge with translation. Okay, and this is a source here by Walter Benjamin. This is a source that was pointed out to me by Rabbi Shlomo Zephyr. And he says, just as a tangent touches a circle lightly, and at but one point establishing with this touch rather than with the point, the law according to which it is to continue on a straight path to infinity. A translation, so there's a circle, right? A translation touches the original lightly and only at the infinitely small point of the sense, thereupon pursuing its own course according to the laws of fidelity in the freedom of linguistic flux. What on earth is he saying here? Who can tell me what he's saying?
Exactly.
It's not a clear reflection of the original. And this is a challenge of interpretation. Try translating a joke in Hebrew into English. You can't do it. Or a Yiddish joke. You have to understand things in their own context and language. Yes.
For several years, I learned with a Rabbi Yosef Leibovich,
mm-hmm.
who was a student of Yoshebek Soloveitchik.
Yeah.
His famous quote is, every translation is an interpretation.
Okay, good. So we're gonna get there, exactly. So I have an article here by Dr. Louis Feldman, Torah and Secular Culture, Challenge and Response in the Hellenistic Period. Dr. Louis Feldman was a professor of the classics in Yeshiva University, and he writes as follows. Franz Rosenzweig, who together with Martin Buber undertook to translate the Bible into German, once wrote in a letter to Gershom Scholem, only one who is profoundly convinced of the impossibility of translation can really undertake it. Okay? I mean, it takes humility and understanding that you're not really going to get it all right. And that there are just certain things that are impossible to translate. Because words carry upon their backs ideas and concepts and whole cultures. And how can, we're going to see some examples of this. Okay? Indeed, in a very real sense, as Leo Beck once remarked, all translation is commentary. If, as language, go to the next page, page 3, and we're going to see some examples of how the Septuagint got certain things wrong. Okay, now this is going to be significant because the Septuagint has an interesting history. In the Torah world, the Septuagint is this legend that we talk about, but it doesn't. No one studies the Septuagint. No one has a Septuagint on their shelf. Why was the Septuagint significant? Because who did use the Septuagint?
The church.
The church. How did they access the Torah? Through the Greek translation. Now, Jerome was one of the church fathers who knew Hebrew. He ultimately translates it, the Vulgate, into Latin from the original Hebrew. Okay, and then, you know, that's used as well. But, and there was some opposition to this, from what I understand from Augustine and other people. But the church is going to use this, and therefore any problems in the translation of the Septuagint in the Greek version is going to cross over into Christian theology, okay? And we're going to see some examples here. Okay, who would like to read for me on page 3? This is also from Dr. Louis Feldman's article. Who would like to read? Elaine, you want to read a little bit? Yeah, you want to go for it? Yeah.
Okay, well, the usual translation?
Yeah, we may hear. Second word, page 3.
We may hear, illustrate the dangers of the translation by noting how the Septuagint renders four key terms, Torah, Emuna, Chesed, and Nefesh. Okay, these are difficult terms to translate.
Okay.
The usual translation of the word Torah in the Septuagint is nomos, law, or custom. But Torah really means direction or instruction in the broadest sense.
It's not just laws. The Torah is not just laws. The first Rashi in the Torah tells us, why didn't we start with the first mitzvah given in the Torah? And the answer, okay, he gives a theological explanation of why we need Sefer Bereshit, but Sefer Torah is much, there's much more teaching. There's stories, there are parables, there are poems, there are lessons, life lessons that we learn beyond just do this and don't do that, right?
I think the Torah is supposed to give us an identity.
See, part of it is also identity. So it's much more than just law or custom. Keep going.
But Torah really means direction or instruction in the broadest sense. The five books of the Torah contain not only law, but also a record of the encounter of God and man, and in particular, a history of the development of the Jewish people. Otherwise, as Rashi, on the very first verse of the Torah, comments, the Torah should have begun not with the creation of the word, but with the first commandment. Indeed, when we read in Psalms, Tehillim, Psalms, okay, Hatzinu Ami Torati, give ear, O my people, to my Torah, what follows is not a recapitulation of the laws, but a history of the Jewish nation.
So Torah can mean, it's a very broad term. Okay, I'll continue reading. The word nomos, however, was by the Greeks traditionally contrasted with physis, with nature. To illustrate the difference, Herodotus tells the story of King Darius of Persia. Herodotus was a historian who asked some Greeks how much money he would have to give them in order to induce them to eat the dead bodies of their fathers. Interesting question. You don't get asked that question every single day, you know? Of course, they were horrified and utterly refused since they were accustomed to burn the dead. He then asked some people from India how much money he would have to give them to get them to agree to burn their dead. They too were horrified since they were accustomed to eat their parents' dead bodies. Okay, two very strange minhagim here in Persian India. Hence concludes Herodotus, quoting Pindar the poet, nomos, custom, is king. Meaning, in each place they have their own custom, their own nomos. Again, in Sophocles' Antigone, anyone here read Antigone?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who espouses, Creon stands for nomos, man-made edict, as against Antigone, who espouses the cause of physis, the unwritten law of nature, which she says transcends nomos. So these are examples of that nomos means custom or law. Therefore, the translation of Torah by nomos is utterly misleading, and yet so far, as we can tell, the translation was never challenged in Hellenistic Jewish literature. The result of this was that Paul, speaking to Hellenized Jews, could refer to Judaism as a purely legalistic religion and can speak of the abrogation of the nomos and of its displacement by the religion of the Spirit. Meaning Paul is, you know, running around the Mediterranean world. We spoke about Paul and telling them Judaism is just a religion of law. It's dry. It's boring. There's no spirit to it. There's no life to this religion. Just do and don't do. Yes or no. Okay. Aser, mutar, you know, kasher, pasul. It's very black and white Judaism. So there's no interest in, people were willing to depart with this. However, we know that Torah is much broader than that. Torah is a system of values, an identity, a history, a destiny, halacha as well, of course, particular things that we do and don't do. The result of this was that Paul, speaking to Hellenized Jews, could refer to Judaism as a purely legalistic religion and could speak of the abrogation of the nomos and of its displacement by the religion of the Spirit. Sometimes, as Rosenzweig once perceptively remarked, history is made in dictionaries. This was one of those instances. Okay.
This argument is ongoing today.
Yeah, correct. Let's go to the next page. Another example here. Okay. The translation of emunah. Now we're going to talk about the word emunah. We spoke about nomos. Now emunah, faith. The translation of emunah by the Greek pistis supplies a second example of what we may call creeping assimilation. It was Martin Buber and his Two Types of Faith who noted the difference between emunah, the unconditional trust in the relationship with God as in one's relationship with one's friend, trust. Okay, emunah is to rely on someone, to trust them, and pistis, faith in an intellectual proposition. Okay? Plato, who was probably the most important single intellectual factor in the process of Hellenization in the East during the Hellenistic period, speaks of pistis in the Republic as an opinion, doxa, as an orthodox. In this discussion of epistemology in the line, it is the next to lowest degree of knowledge. Okay, being inferior to the knowledge of the forms and of mathematical objects and being superior only to the knowledge of the images. So Plato has this whole hierarchy of knowledge, what's important. And pistis, which is the belief in certain intellectual propositions, is very low on the totem pole. While it is true that Philo speaks of pistis as the queen of virtues, for him it is, as for Plato, more of an intellectual quality and hence removed from the central connotation of emunah. So what we see here is that emunah, or at least in the Greek term of pistis, means an intellectual understanding or knowledge. But emunah, as we understand it, is much, much deeper. It's about trust. It's about a relationship. It's about having confidence. It's about a much deeper connection than knowledge. It surpasses knowledge. It's much deeper than knowledge. So you see, you can imagine a more intellectual approach versus, to emunah, to faith, versus faith as being something which is, it's just a part of you. It's a part of your identity. Okay. So here we see two examples of the problem, the challenge of translation. Just to give you an example here of how Feldman, how he tries to resolve this tension here between, some positive approaches to the Septuagint and negative version. So what did he say? The Talmud, on the other hand, speaks of the Septuagint as divinely inspired. For it says that God put counsel into the heart of the 72 translators, so that despite the fact that they worked independently of one another, they emerged with exactly the same version of the Torah. And yet in the treatise Sofrim, the rabbis compare the day when the translation was made to the one when the Israelites made the golden calf. Apparently, they came to realize that while the idea of a translation was an excellent one, once the translation came to be read to the exclusion of the original, this was equivalent to the worship of an idol, a substitute for the truth. Indeed, we may suggest that translation was praised only when those who consulted it recognized that it was not primary but derivative from the original Hebrew. What happens? You create this translation. What happens with the translation? You
accepted it.
Yeah, you rely on it. It's like, okay, we don't need the other one anymore. It becomes obsolete. And that's how it became an idol. So this is how he resolves the... So far we've sort of seen two to three different interpretations here. One is that it's a debate. The four different understandings of the story of the Septuagint date goes back to how positively or negatively do you view Greek wisdom. Okay? That's number one. Point number two is about the challenges, the impossibility of translation. Okay? If you believe translations are an easy thing, it's just a technical thing. You just got to get a good scribe, a good translator in place, and it's easy to do. Or do you say, wait a second, the words of the Torah contain very deep ideas that cannot be translated into other languages. Okay, so that's a second version. The third is sort of how you look at this translation. Do you look at this translation as maybe, you know, a dictionary, something that assists you to understand the original and to maybe an educational tool? Okay, I'm going to, you know, kids who, or people, let's say you have a class for people who don't know Hebrew, but then they want to study the Bible. So you use the Greek version and then you use that to expose them to the Torah text. So it could be an educational tool. But if it replaces the original, then it becomes an idol, an egel hazahav. Okay, so this is how it's really about how we relate to the text itself as replacing, or is it, complementing? Yeah.
Well, you know, in Antigone, for example, when he talks about the because of that, it's exactly the opposite, because the concept uses the laws of Creon, which are considered in Antigone, temporarily, for the moment.
Second.
She goes to Smeni, the laws, of course, this is, which are the laws of eternity, which is what the Torah is supposed to represent. So
yeah.
It's more than just.
Yeah, maybe just turn off the phone. Okay.
It's more than just a mistaken translation. It's a complete change.
Okay. So nachum. So let's now. Let's now get to a perspective presented by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. He's a lecture that he gave in 1987. God and man according to Judaism and Hellenism. Okay. And this is great Hanukkah material. I put in more than we have to read right now because I want you to take this home and read it at the dinner table, Shabbat table, share it with your friends, and Jews and Hellenists alike, okay? So what Rav Lichtenstein is doing here is he wants to compare, in somewhat broad strokes, the differences between Judaism and, you know, and Hellenistic outlook. And to do this, he uses two different examples, okay? For in our tradition, he uses the example of Eov. So we have Eov, Job, versus the myth of Prometheus. Anybody know what happened to Prometheus? What does Prometheus do?
He flies too close to the sun.
No, that was Icarus. What did Prometheus do? Prometheus is the one who, he didn't create it. What did he do? He stole it from the gods. Okay, when the gods try to condemn him, he starts arguing with them, and he says, "Who are you to keep fire away from human beings?" Okay, so he's going to compare these two different models. Okay, and Rav Lichtenstein he's a very sophisticated thinker, and first of all, he's going to really puncture right at the outset how we look at the Greeks. Okay, because Hanukkah, the Jews, and the Greeks, Al Hanisim, and the Greeks are Timuat Heichal, and Rabim Yad Natim, Urshaim Biad Tzadikim, Vizedim Biad Oskei Torah Tachay. He says, wait a second. It's a little bit more complex than that. So let's read inside. It's only natural that starting from childhood, we carry with us cultural baggage, which portrays the Greeks as cruel enemies, forces of darkness who came to destroy our world. As a result, this culture is usually drawn in broad, ugly strokes, identifying Greek culture in general with a crude type of idolatry. As a result of this approach, our work is made somewhat easier. In contradistinction to this world of statues and gods stands our true faith. Needless to say, this approach engenders a certain measure of disdain for Greek culture and philosophy. The disadvantage of such an approach is, in fact, twofold. Firstly, it does not enable us to get to the crux of the issue and prevents us from understanding the full significance of the conflict between the two cultures in a profound way. He says, first of all, we want to understand the differences between these two cultures. If we just say that, they're idolatrous and we're, we have all the truth, it just doesn't, you don't get to the nuances, okay, and the subtleties. Turning the opponent into a straw man makes it easier for us to deal with him, but the real battle in terms of faith and belief, philosophy and culture is never addressed. In addition, the diminution of Greek culture and turning it into something childish cuts us off to some degree from a culture which does, after all, represent one of the cornerstones of the civilized world, whose influences are felt on many different levels. In the ancient world, Greece represented the dominant culture. Without doubt, its contribution to humanity was great, not only in practical manners, but also culturally and spiritually. Even the Rambam and other Rishonim acknowledge this. So, you know, if we just say that they're idolatrous and they're enemies of ours, we're not going to be able to learn the good things from them. Okay, and this is Rav Lichtenstein, classic Rav Lichtenstein, Torah Umada Rav Lichtenstein, that we can draw the good out, the positive parts from secular culture and wisdom, but we also reject those things that are negative. But we need to know what it is, and we need to see it with clear eyes to know what is positive, what is negative. Thus, on the one hand, it is appropriate to recognize the values espoused by Greek culture, some of which we can agree with. On the other hand, we need to pinpoint where we stand in conflict with this culture, because the conflict is no less heated today than it was in the days of the Hashmonaim. Okay? Now, he's going to, as a point of departure, I've chosen one specific subject. This aspect, one of the central ones in the debate between our world and that of the Greek, can be highlighted by comparing the character of Eov with Lahavdil, that of Prometheus, as portrayed both in mythology and literatures, and especially in Aeschylus' work, Prometheus Bound. What I want everyone to do here is to read with your chavruta or on your own until the last paragraph, the bold-faced paragraph. So read that on your own, translate, you know, underline what's important, and just remind me to turn on the recording again when we start again. Okay? So what does Rav Lichtenstein say here? What is the difference between Prometheus's relationship to the gods and Eov's relationship to Hashem? No, who could tell me?
Well, I think we see Hashem as something so far beyond our understanding.
Correct. There's humility. There's a recognition of the disparity that exists between man and God. You could talk to God. You could sort of argue with him, but there's this, Anochi afar va'efer, Avram says. I'm only dust. I'm speaking to you. I'm beseeching you. I'm only dust. What's the relationship between Prometheus and the gods? They're almost like on the same plane.
The Greek gods are seen as human. They have affairs. They run after women.
It's nachon, because the Greek gods are lowered. So, and this happens for two reasons. The Greek gods are sort of more human-like, and humans are seen as being more sort of godlike, divine-like. So there's this, it's sort of like, it's like what high school students do with their teachers. What do they try to do? They try to get them to, they're like, no, we're on the same level here, right? And a teacher who doesn't know how to control a classroom gets sucked into the debates and the arguments and the fighting, and that's exactly what the students want. You think you're above us? You think you could tell us what to do? We're going to bring you down. Okay? And that's exactly that's the job of a high schooler. Okay?
To the demigods.
Nahon, human beings. So there's this, whereas for us, there's more of a disparity. We do believe man was created in the image of God, but first of all, we have the ability to actualize that or to corrupt that. But there's still this disparity. Eov, in the end of the day, no, he's never going to get a full answer from God. And God is not responsible. Lav ba'al dvarim atadi. I don't need to give you an answer, Eov. Okay? Whereas Prometheus is arguing and he's... Now, what is the consequence of this transformation? Indeed, his very point is the source of the main weakness inherent in Greek culture. When viewed from a religious standpoint, Toynbee was correct when he wrote in his book about Greek culture that the cardinal sin, Toynbee was a Christian thinker, that the cardinal sin of Greek culture, from the Christian point of view, was its humanism. Meaning putting man on a pedestal and saying that he's great, the power of the individual, etc. On one end, this was an achievement, a culture with a profoundly humanistic basis. They held man in high esteem and viewed the world through human lenses. On the other hand, the achievement in no way diminished the problematic nature of this philosophy. Together with abandoning all primitive feelings of fear associated with paganism, the transition to Greek humanism also did irreparable harm to the concept of holiness, of Kedusha. Next page. The sense of awe. Not the primitive fear of the early pagans, but true religious fear. The awe associated with holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, the God on high. This diminished and disappeared. When we see gods as humans, only slightly more sophisticated perhaps, or as philosophical abstractions, then there's no longer any room for a sense of fear, awe, or majesty. As mentioned above, together with the question of the relationship between man and God, there's also the question of whether man is a legitimate claimant on God or not. Man's ability to comprehend events. God tells Eov, you don't know, you'll never understand, you are simply not my baal dvarim, my claimant. Okay? Okay, skip a little bit. Last sentence. There is no common basis. The chasm is complete. Creator and creation have two completely separate worlds, and man must recognize this and accept the yoke of divine kingship with humility and submission. The Greeks did not perceive things thus. They saw themselves as existing on the same plane as the higher powers, and even as understanding them. This understanding comes to expression not only in man's rational capacity, okay, but also in man's ability to control everything. If one can understand, one can control, and this applied not just to their perception of the gods, but the world as well. The dominant approach in Greek culture drastically diminished their sense of mystery. They saw the world as comprehensible. Greeks felt they could understand the world. There's no mystery. There's nothing beyond what we can perceive or understand. Okay, reality is single, you know, is one dimension. We just need to figure it out. It's not beyond our comprehension. I want to take this idea and superimpose it back on our discussion about the Septuagint. What is it that the Greeks, and symbolized by Prometheus, who has the boldness, the audacity to steal fire from the gods, to some degree translating the Septuagint, is a repetition of that same error. What is it? It's to tread on holy ground. It's to think, well, if we could translate the Torah into our language, we will then fully understand its meaning. And we will now have control and authority and power over it. Okay? And this is the problem. This is the concern of the rabbis in the Gemara. That now, if the Greeks will just almost feel as if, and the world at large, we get this. We can tell you what this text really means, not you. And therefore the Jewish people lose authority and control of the text. And the same boldness that it takes to translate the Torah is exactly the problem that Rav Lichtenstein is identifying as the core religious problem of Greek thought. This boldness, this audacity, this thinking that you could understand and uncover the mysteries of things. Okay, and by translating the Torah, you are making a very deep text, a text which has 70 dimensions, Shivim Panim LaTorah, into a one-dimensional text. Using Greek language that doesn't at all capture Jewish concepts of emunah and nomos in the Torah, etc. Yeah.
You can understand something and how it functions, and you can control it also.
Exactly, nachon, and that's exactly the concern that this will cause error and you know lead to a total misinterpretation of the Torah. Okay. Now let's go to page 6, the bottom of page 6. Just a little bit more and then we'll conclude. Dr. Moshe Shoshan, what he points out here very interestingly is that beyond, you know, with regards to the Septuagint and the different versions and, you know, let's come back to this. He says there's a cultural power play here. Because again, if Ptolemy can translate the Torah, it means he has access to it. Okay, it means that he can control it. I'll give you an example, maybe an example today that might be useful. You know, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, mm-hmm. Okay, he's not such a good guy, okay? Julian Assange, he claims that, this is just my own views on him, he claims that he's trying to shed light on things and to illuminate all of us so that we can know what's happening, you know, behind the scenes. Really, he's actually an anarchist who's much more pro-Russian than he is democratic values. And, you know, it's interesting that he really just shares, you know, secrets from the American government, but doesn't do the same thing, you know, with the Russians or with, the, you know, any of the bad actors in the world and Chinese. So it's interesting what it is that he exposes. But in any case, it's the same thing as when he took, he got all, hold of all these diplomatic cables and, you know, channels in the American government. When you expose them, what happens? People read them and say, "Ah, look how so and so is speaking about the Brazilian prime minister, and look at this and that." And these are part of like, you know, much. These are whole. You have to need it in context. You have to see the whole conversation. You have to see, you know, what it is they're talking about. And And then it leads in the end to tremendous confusion, okay, and manipulation and deception. And you say, oh, look what the Americans are doing. Look what they say about this. And then this guy's upset and this guy's upset. And this stuff was never supposed to be exposed. It was supposed to be understood in a particular context by diplomats who understand, you know, who are skillful in this area and know what they're talking about. And it's not meant for the public. It's not meant to be put on the internet. Same thing is true with the Torah. It's meant to be interpreted within a Jewish context by Jews and not exposed to, you know, just put on the library shelf like everything else. And so there are these, you know, power, you know, politics at play of Ptolemy is trying to, this is his form of element, way of dominating the Jewish people by translating their texts. And this also explains our hesitancy in doing this and engaging in this endeavor. Let's go to the last page here, okay, of the source sheet. Okay, and we'll just see one more piece. The final position that we saw, the catastrophic version, you know, they saw, Shoshan argues that this was written after seeing what the Christians did with the Septuagint. These writers saw the production of the Septuagint, last page, which made the text of the Old Testament accessible to all nations as a necessary precursor to the revelation of Jesus and his gospel to all humankind. So they use bottom of page 7. They use the translation of the Torah into the Septuagint as an argument for the spreading of you know, Judaism to the world in the form of Christianity. Furthermore, many patristic writers sought to combat the claim that the Septuagint was not a legitimate witness to and interpreter the original text. This was especially important in the case of disputed texts such as Isaiah 7:14. This is famous. Christians famously relied on the Septuagint's use of the term parthenos to argue that this passage foretells the virgin birth. Jewish interpreters rejected this reading, arguing that the original Hebrew ha'alma refers to a young woman who will have child with Chezkiah and not the miraculous birth of the Son of God. You see, the word is alma, not bitula. So, the Greeks got it wrong. So they got it wrong, and then this becomes a foundation of Christian theology. The Septuagint legend was thus crucial to Christian writers to establish that the Septuagint was an authoritative and perhaps even divinely revealed source. The authors of the Sefer Torah, the Masechet Sofrim, were almost certainly aware of the centrality of the Septuagint to the rise of Christianity. Okay? So what we see here is that when the Torah is translated into Greek, it actually has a lot more consequences. Because it means that we lose control of Torah interpretation. Okay? It also means that that what happens is that you start to look at the Torah, and this is the final point, and this is as we see in Aristeas and Philo, you start to look at the Torah through the lens of another culture. Okay? And you try to, you know, you try to resolve the tensions between these things, okay? And so the Torah is meant to be sui generis. It's our particularistic, asher b'charbanim yikolamim v'natalenu etzarato. It's not meant to be, it's not even, one is not able truly to translate the Torah. Every translation is an interpretation and in some ways a corruption. And this is the story of, in some ways, of Chanukah. And about the uniqueness of the Jewish people and our Mesorah, our tradition. So this is the story that precedes Chanukah. Okay? So next week, during the Yom Yud, you can study more about the actual story of Chanukah with a little bit of background about how we got there. Yisher koach, have a good day, everybody. Okay.